Tomorrow night, the Fresno Art Museum plays host to a special event presented by Cal Humanities. It's part of their On the Road series of events bringing together thought leaders from across the state in a variety of different disciplines. The event in Fresno is very important and relative to our main industry in Central California, agriculture. It's called the Farm Worker Movement in California from Chavez onwards. Joining us now to talk about the event is Pulitzer Prize winner Miriam Powell on how the farm worker movement of the past can help inform the future. Miriam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
There's a perception out there that the farm labor movement ran out of steam after Cesar Chavez died. Is that accurate?
I think that it's accurate, but it's more accurate to say that it ran out of steam long before he died, actually. It ran out of steam sometime in the mid-early 1980s. And really, by the time he died in 1993, there was not much going on. There were very few union contracts left, and that situation has persisted to this day. There have been many changes in the labor market and also in the regulatory system and so on, but the bottom line is that a lot of the gains that were achieved, at least in terms of the unionization of farm workers, evaporated long ago.
So why did that happen? Why did you see that change? Because certainly the UFW had a very strong voice in the 1970s and in the late 60s. And then, as you said, things changed. Why is that?
You know, it's a complicated story, and there were a lot of factors. The sort of shorthand bottom line is that Chavez himself took the movement in a very different direction and made a lot of decisions toward the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s that really weakened the labor movement part of the UFW per se. And so a lot of the best organizers and the strongest people left at that point and went on and did other things, so that there was a lot of turmoil back now 40 years. And a lot of it really stems from the passage of the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in 1975. Then Governor Jerry Brown made it a priority to make California the only state in the country that has a system that actually sets out a mechanism for farm workers to petition to join a union and to have protected union rights because they're excluded under the National Labor Relations Act. And so that was a big victory and led to a lot of elections and a lot of activity and a lot of leadership growing out of the fields. But at the same time, it very much sort of changed the nature of the union and the movement. And this is sort of that prompted a lot of change. But I think one of the things that I would like, and I think that this discussion tomorrow will focus on, is what were the tactics that Chavez and the movement used back in the years when they did have so much success against, you know, enormous odds, and what kinds of real basic community organizing tactics they used, and how are those relevant today, both in terms of farm workers and, you know, increasingly a lot of the rest of the economy resembles the conditions that farm workers were in and faced back then, as we see sort of this, you know, increasing gig economy, and farm labor contractors are back and forth, but so are many other kinds of middlemen and contractors in everything from Uber to technology jobs and so forth. So I think that history can kind of guide us in looking at both the successes and the failures of the farm worker movement, and what can people who are looking to take on the system or change or address income inequality today learn from what happened back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s.
Now, speaking of this event, tomorrow night you'll be joined on stage by Luis Valdez, a co-founder of El Triacho Campesino, as well as Don Mabalon and Samuel Orozco from Radio Bilingue. About this event, you mentioned looking at those tactics. What are they? Some of them, at least.
You know, what was enormously important about what Chavez did was to empower the poorest people and sort of teach them how, by joining together in very basic community organizing ways and tactics, with house meetings, with making their demands clear, with, you know, the kinds of things that he began his career doing are going to sound very similar. They're voter registration drives, English clashes, citizenship drives, a lot of the things that we see happening again today. And I know that in the Valley, there is a movement. There was a Faith in the Valley conference a couple of weeks ago where there are groups that are trying to start to replicate that. The labor movement as a whole, as you know, has taken, you know, huge hits in the last few decades, and union membership has declined. And I think people are looking at different kinds of models of how to empower poor people to make demands on a system and to be enfranchised in ways that perhaps they have not been now for some time.
You mentioned a while ago the ALRB. This is a creation of Governor Brown in his first stint in Sacramento. The ALRB has been in the news a lot lately. Is it working as intended? And now you have Governor Brown back in Sacramento. Are you surprised that he has not been more involved in working with the ALRB and trying to change things there?
Well, I think that he has actually done a lot with the ALRB and with OSHA and with other things. I think that he has done a lot to empower, to do what the state, to do what he can in terms of the state, in terms of putting people in positions who are going to enforce the law. The chairman of the ALRB, William Gould, is one of the most respected labor lawyers in the country, was the head of the NLRB under Bill Clinton, and I think the board is doing a lot. It's got an effort right now to try to do education, to send agents out, to reach out to workers just to inform them of their rights, particularly when you have, you know, an increasingly indigenous workforce and people who may not even speak Spanish or English. So the board is trying to do what it can, but the entire system and the board and the law was set up on the assumption that there would be a very active labor union out organizing farm workers. In fact, at the time that the law passed, there were two unions competing, the Teamsters and the United Farm Workers. We went head-to-head for a number of years in elections in the fields, and the Teamsters also had a lot of contracts at that time. So the system was set up to, you know, respond to a situation where you had active unions that were organizing and petitioning for elections. That has not been the case for many years now. There are real limits to what the board can do in terms of initiating activity on behalf of farm workers themselves. I know that there's been a lot of attention to the Garawan case in Fresno, and I think that's sort of still dragging on somewhere in the courts and in the system, right? It may go on for years. But, you know, what was notable about the Garawan case is that's an election that the UFW won, I believe, in 1991, 92. Chavez was still alive. And they, under this sort of quirk and amendment to the law that was passed a few years ago, went back and you know, essentially said, we never had a first contract and we're entitled to have one now. So, you know, just the fact that they were going back to an election that had been won so many decades ago, I think it also sort of tells you something about the level of activity or the lack thereof.
Not to get too much into the Garawan case right now, because it's a complex nest of stories, yeah, and things, but how significant is that to the UFW? This is a big contract. It's thousands and thousands of employees, presumably. And we've heard various stories about the union ranks, the current union ranks of the UFW over the years. How significant is that and those workers? How significant are those workers to the future of the UFW itself today?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it would probably double their membership. They have so few members at this point under actual contracts. So, you know, it would be a huge influx for them of dues. They get 3% of the dues of their members. And, you know, that's been very much, of course, an issue in whether the workers really want the union or not, and who knows. But it clearly would be a significant influx of money for them. But I think in terms of their own, you know, influence or reputation or activities, probably not all that central. I mean, they've really positioned themselves as much more of a political lobbying force than a bread and butter, you know, labor union representing workers these days.
As we saw a few years ago, the state implemented new heat safety regulations for farm workers. Then just a few weeks ago, Governor Brown signed a new overtime bill for farm workers. What's next on the agenda of labor groups and lawmakers as these things are also much in the legislative debate, not just in the collective bargaining process, in terms of improving the conditions for farm workers?
Right, absolutely. And a lot of the major things that have been done, as you say, have been done legislatively. And I think parenthetically, that's something that the governor has, you know, paid attention to and also been very careful about what he does and doesn't do. I mean, he also listens to agriculture. He's pretty pretty careful about that. I think that the biggest impact for farm workers is going to be the increase in the minimum wage. That is going to have probably more dollars and cents impact on the workers than anything else that has happened lately. And the overtime bill or law is clearly important symbolically and in terms of establishing the idea that farm workers are not second-class citizens, or not second-class workers, and are subject to the same benefits as any other kind of worker. What it's going to actually mean in terms of dollars is, I think, very unclear, and we'll find out. But there are a lot of questions about how much it's going to actually mean to workers on a dollars and cents basis. The other kind of ironic thing is that the workers who are covered under UFW contracts are going to be exempt from the new overtime provisions because of the way the state labor law works. So they will not actually be the beneficiaries, although they were the big lobbyists for it. So I think that you'll continue to see measures that try to legislatively use the mechanism of the state to improve health and safety and working conditions for farm workers, and that will certainly be the direction that some of the advocacy groups like CRLA and others work for as well. You know, I should say wage theft, I think, is going to be the big focus. There is tremendous problems, and there's been lots documented about this, where not only in farm workers, but lots of low-wage jobs and service industries, that wage theft is an enormous problem.
Miriam Pavel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, has studied the life of Cesar Chavez. She is part of a panel discussion taking place tomorrow night at the Fresno Art Museum from Cal Humanities as part of their On the Road series. It's called The Farm Worker Movement in California from Chavez Onwards. It also features playwright and co-founder of El Teatro Campesino, Luis Valdez, as well as Professor Don Mabalon and Samuel Orozco of Radio Bilingue. 7 p.m. tomorrow night at the Fresno Art Museum. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.